Today is February 2nd, 2006. It's Thursday, approximately 9:15 a.m. We're preparing to interview Sam Fountain. First, we'll go around the table.
Doug Rademacher.
Marilyn Coulter.
John Fidowa.
Earl Nicholson.
Gary Judy.
And this is Cheryl McClay. We're at the Frank Dreyer Greenhouse. Sam, will you please state your name and spell your last name for us?
It's Samuel Fountain. My last name is spelled F-O-U-N-T-A-I-N.
And what is your address?
It's 15764 Airport Road, Lansing, Michigan.
And are you married? Do you have children?
Yes, I'm married. I have six children, six boys.
And a little bit on your education level.
Graduated from Alma High School, 2 years of college at LCC. That was to get my degree in skilled trades.
And were you in the military?
I was in the military for 2 years, drafted. One of the biggest draft calls that they had in '66. Spent 19 months over in Germany. Came out of the service as a E5 sergeant. That's about it.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Lakeview, Michigan. Kelsey Memorial Hospital. I was delivered by Dr. Kelsey himself. From there, I went to school at Lakeview, kindergarten. We moved to Blanchard and went to school there, second grade. Moved to Edmore, went to school there for about 1 year, and then we moved to Riverdale. I went through the eighth grade there, and then I finished my high school in Alma High School.
And what did your parents do?
They were farmers. We had two farms. We pretty much, that was all we did. We didn't have any outside income besides the farm, so that was it. Pretty much poor folks.
Sam, what did you do before you hired in at Fisher Body?
I had a job at Gibson's. I worked as a online. I put the door panels on the doors, and I worked there a real short time before going into the service.
And when did you hire in? What is your seniority date at Fisher Body?
I hired in September 4th, 1968.
What made you seek out Fisher Body? Why did you go there?
A lot of my friends were working down here, and the money. That was probably one of the best paying jobs around.
Could you tell me a little bit about the process of hiring? Where did you put in your application?
I went in and saw, I believe it was Jerry Brooks, and I put in my application, and he wanted to know when I could get started. I mean, that was back in the day when you could hire in and go right to work, and if you didn't like it, you could quit, and then you could come back in and hire in again. It was not like it is today. It's just completely different.
Can you tell us, do you remember the first day once you were hired in, where they took you, what you did?
Oh, yeah. I went in a room that was probably 10 by 10, and there's probably 25 people in there. This little supervisor came in here. He's a general foreman, Marshall Dean, flat top, kind of a drill sergeant type of guy. Comes in there and he goes, you, and you, come with me. And he took them out to wherever they needed help. And then he'd come back in there and you, and that's the way they did it. And, you know, you went out and got put on a job and you were on your way. And it was kind of scary at first, but then you settle in with the people, you know, and stuff. So it worked out fine.
And did he take you somewhere? Did he finally call your name? And
oh, he didn't call me by name. They just you. He grabbed you and away you went. And then it was up to your supervisor to figure out who you were, I guess. And you know, make sure he got paid and so forth. But he was just in there just picking help and taking them wherever he needed them.
And where were you taken to?
Trim, which is now M Trim. And I got probably one of the hardest jobs there was, I think. I don't know.
What was that?
Back in those days, they put, instead of the power door locks, they put vacuum door locks. And you had a cluster of hoses that fit through a door that you wouldn't think that would go through the hole in the door. And they run these back to back to back. And I was up and down that line like a yo-yo. And back then, too, we were working like 9 hours, 10-3, you know, big day.
And so you started on the line. How long did you work on the line?
I worked on the line for 10 years. And then there were jobs coming up in the trades. That's how I got into the trades. So I interviewed for that, took their test. And then after, 5 years, I guess, I finally got into the trades. Openings and gradually make it to the top of their list there before they accepted me.
So in the 10 years that you were on the line, did you do the door lock job the whole time?
No, I did all... I thought that there wasn't a job I couldn't do. I did all the way from... At that time, it was vinyl tops. I did all the way from vinyl tops clear to 3X where the finished product was. I did most everything, all there was to do. I was a utility man for the biggest part of my career. I was a relief man. You had to relieve like 8-10 people, depending. And then part of that time, I did the door wire job and so forth. So I was mostly in the wiring.
Marilyn Coulter, excuse me, Sam, could you please tell me what a utility man is?
There was a person that, if they needed some help in other areas or even in your own area, people missing or whatever, you jumped in and did that particular job that the person was missing. You kind of a utility person, you could do like any of the jobs, I guess.
So in order to be a utility person, you had to be able to learn jobs quickly?
Yes, okay. Yes.
And also, could you explain what a relief man does?
A relief man is a person that gives each individual in your particular area a relief so they can go to the bathroom, get something to eat, or whatever they might want to do in their free time, the 15 minutes or whatever that you give them.
Do you think that hiring in on the line before going into skilled trades helped you at all once you entered into the skilled trades arena?
Yes, because I knew most of the people that were on the line. There's a little bit of friction between the tradespeople and the production workers. They think we just sit around drinking coffee all day, but it's not quite the case. I knew most of the people, and they knew that the way I worked and stuff, and I didn't really have too much of a problem with it.
Do you think that was the only friction between the production people and the trades people?
We got paid more, and they probably thought we did less work. I don't know. They didn't always see us when we're in the really nasty, you know, parts of the plant that we were really busting our butts and, you know, weren't real crazy about being there, but it had to be done to get, you know, production going again. So.
Earl Nicholson.
Yeah, we've talked about the friction. Let's talk about something fun for a second. Let's talk about all the cool stuff that you skilled trade guys used to play with. You know, all the cranes and the the tools. And the, you know, what was your favorite machine?
You probably hit on most of them there. The crane was fun to operate.
Did you get to operate the crane?
Oh yes, definitely.
And was there? And did you? Were you sent to school to operate that, or was that a part of your original skill trades training?
You know, when we first hired in, it was kind of things weren't as strict as they are now, which is a good thing. But I mean, the OSHA and stuff, you know, cracking down on the what you have to know and whatever. But back then, if you were capable of running the crane, fork truck, whatever we had, you just jumped on and you did it, you know. And but now you have to be schooled and so forth and all the safety aspects of it. But it's fun, you know. It's just, you know, you kind of take a little pride in being good at, you know, doing your job. You know, it's like person working on the line, putting, you know, their parts on the car, that you get good at it after a while. And it's,
what was the largest tool you had in your toolbox?
My toolbox is pretty small because you have to carry that. I don't know. That's pretty big hammers. I don't know. Big crescent wrenches, stuff like that.
Well, we're talking, what, 4-inch, 5-inch, 6-inch, 12?
Oh, I had a 16-inch crescent wrench. The really big tools that we used was jackhammers, you know. But you didn't carry those. You had to go to the crib and check them out. That's, you know, that's not a tool that you carry around. You know, but those are kind of fun to run. You know, it's nothing like you see on TV. These things work you to death. You know, I mean, not only to shake you, you have to move them. That's the hard part of it. So,
Gary, Judy, you said you worked on the line, so you probably had friends that worked on the line. And being in mill rates, did your supervisors, how did they assign work, and did you have friends that worked on the line that asked you for special favors, and what was it that they asked for, and how much of your workload was that, the special favors?
Oh, yeah, you had special favors that your best buddies, you know, they want a locker built or something like that, and then I had to have friends, and, you know, because we couldn't be in a mill ranch, you can't do it all. You've got to have the tinsmiths cut the steel for you, the tin and so forth. And you had buddies after you all the time, you know. And our supervisors knew that, and we wouldn't get too crazy with it. But, you know, you take care of your buddies, and, you know, they take care of you too when you're out on the line. If you got something going on, you know, plant's pretty big. I don't know it all. You know, you go out there and say, hey, what did you see here on this breakdown before it broke down? You know, and you kind of quiz them a little bit, and then you kind of sort it out. So,
Did they have a special name for those jobs that you did for friends on the side?
Oh, yeah, government jobs? Is that what you're after? Yeah. We did a lot of those, you know, things that we could do without jeopardizing our job, you know. So.
Did you ever find, did any supervisors ever give you a hard time about doing extra?
No, they understood. They were part of the people that come in and ask us for favors too, you know. So.
Do you remember any jobs in particular that you did that kind of stood out on a government job? Or?
Oh, gosh, I didn't know.
They were kind of strange or out of the ordinary?
No, I don't. Nothing really sticks out. So.
Nobody, Earl Nicholson, nobody ever asked you to do a bronze statue or anything like that. Nothing crazy, just toolboxes. And,
yeah. You know, or outside work. supervisors wanted.
Gary, Judy.
Yeah. To do outside work for something that wasn't used in the plant, maybe, or...
Oh, yeah, guys that had, you know, stuff with their garden tractors, whatever, you know, a part broke or something, they bring it in, we weld it, stuff like that. Yeah, that happened all the time. Yeah, and that's no big deal.
I had a few of those things done myself. Yeah. I appreciated it, too.
Yeah, well, that's, yeah, that kind of
special tools that I needed or something.
Yeah. Yeah. That kind of keeps the people.
Doug Rademacher.
Sam, I want to go back. You said your parents were farmers. And what kind of farm did they have? Did you run? You said all they did was farm. Did you do all, at that time, all your food? Did you go grain and cattle? Or what exactly did you farm?
Yeah, we had kind of a small dairy farm. I think we milked, you have to realize this is back in the 60s, but we milked maybe 20 cows, 25 cows. We had maybe 100 head of young cattle running most of the time. And then in order to have that many cattle, you kind of feed them. So we had our own corn, our own wheat, beans, all that stuff. We had, I think a couple, 200 acres, something like that. I can't remember exactly how many acres were tillable, but we were pretty self-sufficient on, you know, the whole thing there.
I want to ask you, you said you worked at Gibson's. What is Gibson's? Where is it located, and what did they make?
Gibson's is a refrigerator plant where I worked. I worked there a short time. I got drafted into the service from there, but that's in Greenville. At that particular time, I was living over by Lakeview, and I would drive back and forth there. My father worked there. That's kind of why I worked. Hired in there, and then I got, like I say, drafted, and then I kept all my seniority. But when I got out of the service, I elected to come to GM rather than go back there.
You work the assembly line at Gibson's. Refrigerators are a large item, and they go by I don't know how many at a time. But you moved into the Fisher Body Plant when you returned from the service. And those are big vehicles. And how you worked a assembly line, can you tell me the difference between what did it look like to walk out into a assembly line with cars? Can you give a description of that? Were you ready for that vision? Or?
I really didn't know what I was getting into to come down here, but I had friends that worked at Fisher Body, and I suspected that it couldn't be too much different than Gibson. It's an assembly line of the, you know, parts move by, you assemble stuff, so it's, you know. The main reason I came over was the money. The money wasn't quite there at Gibson's. They weren't paying the same per hour rate, so I elected to hire in here at Fisher Body.
It was Gary, Judy.
One more question. I wanted to know, did you continue to work the farm and help your family while you worked in the factory?
By that time, my stepfather there had kind of semi-retired from farming. He was still doing the raising the corn and beans and stuff, but he was out of the dairy and so forth, young cattle. And so he was just kind of easing his way out of it. So he didn't really need our help. I drove from Alma back and forth to work, but as far as working on the farm, no, I didn't do much of that.
Gary, Judy, you say you worked at Gibson's and then you came to Fisher Body. Was Gibson's a union plant?
Yep, yes it was. And as a matter of fact, I transferred my initiation fee.
For the union?
For the union from Gibson's over here. It was I can't remember the exact numbers, but it was quite a difference in the amount. I'm going to say it was like $5 at Gibson's, and it was like $20 or something like that here, and I got to transfer it over, so I transferred it over, didn't have to pay my initiation fee.
Coming from another union plant, did you notice much of a difference between the unions and the way they operated? Was one more militant than the other, or...? Was there much of a difference in the environment of the?
I was a young person at the time when I was over in Gibson. I was only 19 years old, and I really wasn't into the union, and I only worked there a short time before I went into the service, so I really didn't have much thinking of the how the union worked. I was just there for the money, and it was a short period of time. Since I hired in the Fisher Body, yes, the union was, come into play, more so.
Felt it was a lot stronger union than Fisher.
Yeah.
Cheryl McQuaid, how old were you when you hired in Fisher Body?
I was 21.
And do you remember some of the people that you hired in with?
Oh, yeah. I mean, to name names?
No. Did any of them work right by you?
Oh, yes.
And you kept in contact with them? And
yes, a lot of them. Some of them are gone now, passed away. Some of them, bigger and better jobs, But, yeah, we used to hang out. We used to have a good time, We would work on a line, and it seems that my bench was the card-playing bench. So.
What kind of cards did you play?
Tunk.
And was that at breaks or lunch?
Pretty much all the time.
All the time? Whenever the line broke down or anything? What did you do for lunch with some back when you were on production?
Oh, well, I drove from up north, so pretty much carried my lunch. And in those days, you had the wagon that came around. You got a snack about that. So I don't remember going out very much, across the street or whatever.
Do you remember when you hired in, did anybody do a initiation prank on you? Did you see anybody else get pranked, or did you prank anybody?
Oh, yeah. I, being not a very big person, and I wasn't a very big person at that time, I used to get thrown in the trunk of the cars as they're going down the line. And this one particular gentleman was about 6'6", weighed about 300 pounds, and he threw me in there a lot of times. I remember times where another relief man taped me to a column with this black, looks like duct tape. I mean, you're there to stay until somebody lets you. I've been stuck in the 50-gallon trash containers. That's what they use for trash containers. Stuck in there butt first, and you can't get out of those either. Talking about pranks, I just did.
And this was not mean, these were just...
No, this was just all in fun. No, everybody was... It was kind of, people come in, it was kind of like your home away from home. It was kind of a, your other family, I guess. So, yeah, there was nothing, they weren't doing this to be, mean or hurt you or anything.
So how would you get out of some of these situations?
Oh, you had buddies that felt sorry for you and they let you up, or your job's going down the line and not getting done, so they would help you out, and then help you catch back up and stuff. Yeah, it was all fun.
So it was kind of they would prank you, but yet they would make it so you didn't get in trouble.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So there was no disciplinary measures
for
any of this?
No.
Marilyn Colton, so what kind of pranks, if those are done to you, what types of things did you do to other people?
Oh, I being a small person, I kind of knew my limitations. I don't remember really getting anybody back. I might have helped, myself and another person help grab a guy and tape him to a column or something, but not... I didn't do anything myself, by myself. So
it was a nice family, the environment was fun.
Yeah, it was fun.
And these are things that happened when the line would go down or for breaks or things? Or?
This would happen when the lines run,
Just stay with the pass of time.
Oh, yeah.
What types of hours were you working back then?
I remember working a lot of 10-hour days. 10-3. I remember when you worked 10-3, the people, I was working days for quite a long time, and people couldn't get in, the other shift couldn't get in the parking lot because the day shift hadn't left yet. That's how bad it was. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. close, and the line would stop for like 6 minutes or something, and then the people would, you know, just swap jobs.
Do you remember about how many people were working back then as far as numbers, in thousands or something?
I want to say at one time we had like 6,500.
Say about 6,500 people. So you were working days, and you were from Alma.
Yeah.
And you drove back and forth in. Did you come in by yourself? Did you carpool?
Well, this is back when the gas was cheap, but we still carpooled. We had like five guys that would we'd take turns driving mm-hmm. from there. We'd park at the 300 Bowl in Alma and drive, you know, the 40, 50 miles, whatever.
Now, is this something that you pretty much continued throughout your career at Fisher Body?
I moved down here to Lansing, so and so I didn't have to make that long drive.
So what was it like when you had to commute in the wind, in the weather and things like that?
Oh, it was terrible. I mean, luckily most of it was main highways, but I remember a lot of times going home, it was like a two-track going down 27. I mean, it was really bad.
So how long have you lived in Lansing area?
1971.
Okay, so you've been here a while. Yeah.
We bought a house, it was just across the street from the Fisher Body.
Across the street from Fisher Body?
Yeah, on Genesee Drive. So.
So what's it like to live in a community that's that close to a factory? Can you tell us about that?
Oh, I got a lot of remarks from my buddies saying, I wouldn't live in the big city. And I said, I'm home and in my house before you can get the frost scraped off your windshield. And I really care. You know, that's time, you know, out of your life that you're traveling on the road. And I really, you know, that helped me. I enjoyed living here in town. So
were there ever, like, big noises coming from the factory? What was it like to have it right in your community? Did it ever bother your community? Did it help your community?
I didn't mind living close. Noises, no. That was the main concern of my buddies, saying, oh, you're not going to like it down here. It's going to be too noisy. And I never noticed that. I like living close. I'd come home for lunch. I don't know, I just enjoyed it. I mean, that was my choice to live that close. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could have lived down a little farther, but I enjoyed living close to plant.
So now I know one other question I want. I know you said you went across the street sometime for lunch. Across the street to where?
Oh, to the bar, over to Harry's.
Oh, Harry's. And now, was that on Michigan? Was it on Saginaw?
That's on Verlinden.
So did they have food there also,
yeah.
Or was it just...
Yep, food, drinks.
So what types of things were done there? Was it just for lunch? Did you go there after work? Was there any things that you and your friends from work did there?
When I was in the trades, we'd go over there quite regular. We'd go over and just kind of, you know, a release from the plant, you know, I mean, just to get outside and kick back with the guys. And as far as after work, no, I didn't go there after work. So.
Earl Nicholson here. You mentioned the trades. You were, when, how long were you working production? How many years did you work in production before you went to skilled trades?
I worked production for 10 years. I went into trades in 1978, November of 78.
Was that a momentous decision? I mean, was that, you know, one of those life altering decisions that you look back on and you're happy with or sad at, or?
I thought about it for a long time. I'm because the trades were working 7 days a week and stuff like that. But I had thought, you know, that was a stepping stone to better myself, and I made the decision, and I have no regrets. You know, I was
Gary Judy. So you were married at the time before you went on trades, and if so, how did your wife feel about that? If you were, I mean, 7 days a week—that's a—that's a lot of committed time to the factory.
Yes, I was married at the time, and the only thing I could say about the 7 days a week, it was only 8 hours a day. I remember when I first went into trades, I worked. I didn't take any vacations. I could probably count on one hand the days that I took off or didn't work. I mean, I was there after the money, and my wife was okay with it. I mean, we live real comfortable, but I worked pretty hard for what I got, too.
Did you notice people that you work with in trades that had problems because of the hours you guys work and the days, all the time you put in?
I can't really say that we had, it was kind of like a game, you know. I mean, you worked 7 days a week, and that was just the way it was, you know. I mean,
it wasn't a higher divorce rate or anything.
Well, probably. I got divorced in that time, too, but I don't know if that was the cause of it. Yeah. I suppose I had a stress, you know, but I don't know, it's just, you know, it's part of your career, you know, it's things that you do.
Sam, Marilyn Coulter, question. I know that they say there's a divorce rate inside from working hard, and that's with any job, actually, but do you know, did your wife work? Did she work in the plant? Was she familiar with people in the plant?
My wife, my first wife, did not work. She didn't work in the plant. She didn't work at all. She stayed home. At that time, I had four young children. She stayed home with the children. So I thought that was her job to, you know, as long as I was trying to make some money.
So there's a second wife?
Yes, I got divorced, and then in 87, and then I married a lady from work. She had two children, so we have six boys altogether. They range from 33 down to 21.
So work also brings about a lot of romances also. Yes? Is that for a lot of people who work there met their spouses?
Yeah, probably. I don't know.
What was it like to date and marry somebody that you work with? It's difficult, easy?
I don't know. She didn't work there very long. She had a health issue and took a buyout. As far as dating and stuff, I'm a busy man. I mean, work a lot of hours.
But a lot of your coworkers have met their spouses right there.
Few people I know, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's true.
So, what department you hired in trim, right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And you were in trim, and you were in skilled trades also. Were there many women in trim? Were there many women in skilled trades? And how did that work for you?
In trim, yeah, I'd say there was a few women, you know. I mean, not when I first hired in, you know, you didn't see that many women. But yeah, as the years progressed on, there was more women that hired in and so forth. But in the trades, there's not very many women. We had one female millwright. She doesn't work there. Well, I take it back. We got another female millwright. I forgot about her, too. But there's like two female millwrights, which is kind of uncommon because that's pretty heavy work, you know. Not saying they can't do it, but it's pretty demanding, you know. I don't know about the other trades. They don't have that many female in there either, so hopefully that answered your question.
Well, it's different in terms of working with them. How did that, when you first hired in, it wasn't that many, and then how did that change your environment? Was there things that you guys had to quit doing? Would it make your environment better? What do you think about it?
I worked with both the female millwrights, both of them for quite some time. They're just like any other partner, you know. You know what they're good at, and you know what you're good at, and you just try to, you know, do your best between the two of you on a breakdown or a job that you, assignment that you get.
And one other question: I know you said you had friends on the line, you obviously married one also.
Mm-hmm.
Did any of your other friendships extend outside the plant, and do they still exist today?
I don't know. I was trying to think of any people that I do things with on the outside that work online. I have, but not on a, you know, regular basis.
Or in your trade.
I'm drawing a blank right now. I don't.
I said one last question. I wanted. Did you find that skilled trades folks are different, or any difference between line workers in terms of their closeness and their camaraderie? From working with people 7 days a week and spending so much time with it, did you get closer to them as opposed to the people that you worked with on the line?
I think it's the same either way. The production people, when I worked with them, you know, you get close to people. You know, people come in there and they tell you what's going on in their lives and stuff. It's the same way with the tradespeople. The tradespeople are, you see them more often, but it's the same, I think it's the same environment. You know, you talk about what's going on in your life on the outside and so forth.
Earl Nicholson.
We touched on the subject of women in the factory. When you first hired them, there weren't really there. Minorities in general. When initially we're talking basically mostly white male organization, skilled trades, you had minorities coming into skilled trades in the 70s, women probably in the 80s. You know, was there any, I don't know if I say resentment, but was there resistance to that change amongst the groups, amongst the different trades?
I didn't see it. If there was, I don't know.
Was it basically as long as a man could pull his weight, he was accepted?
Well, you know, it's just like it is in society. You know, people are better at certain things, and you know, and I can't really nail it down saying, yeah, if a guy could pull his own weight. You kind of, you know, like, I'm not a very big person. You're obviously a bigger person than I am, so if we have something that has to be moved, you're going to be doing more lifting than I am. You know, I mean, just kind of generalizing the situation. But I don't know. We worked around that. I mean, I didn't see any. It's like a big family. I mean, I don't know. I'm a pretty easygoing guy, and I guess maybe I didn't, you know, see any of that, or didn't want to see it, or whatever. I don't like to, you know, stir the pot and.
Let's get into the issue of supervision for just a second.
Okay.
When we started seeing female supervisors, was there resistance to that? Females in leadership positions.
I'll tell you one thing, and in the trades that probably a lot of people didn't see. You know, they're going to tell us what they want done, and that was kind of the, in the general thing, is kind of how it went. They tell us, okay, this is your job, you know, and then they kind of left it up to us to do it the best way we thought. So if whether it be male or female saying, oh, well, I want it done this way, and these are the steps you're going to do it, that didn't really happen, you know. I mean, unless there was some direction from way above telling them that this is the way it's going to happen. But
was there any resentment to accepting a check from a woman or a minority?
Not from me, no.
Well, okay, from the people you worked around.
I
didn't see that.
Cheryl McCoy, you mentioned that you spent most of your time on day shift. Did you spend any time on second shift?
Well, that's not exactly true. I spent quite a lot of time on afternoons.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. I when I hired in on production, I spent probably the first year on days. After that, I went to nights, and then when I went into trades, I was on, being an apprentice, I was on all three shifts, but I ended up on afternoons for the most part, and then toward the latter part of my career, I was on days. So,
could you tell us a little bit about the differences in the shifts that you saw? What were some of the...
Well, on third shift in the trades, you know, you go, how can these guys sleep like they do? But I tell you what, third shift is not for me. I could sleep too. I mean, I'm not one to say, hey, yeah, I'm going to lay down and take a nap during, you know, the time they're supposed to be working. But you get, your body physically gets to the part where, you know, if you sit down, you're going to conk out, because that's, you're not made to stay up at all hours of the night. At least my body isn't, so.
So there's a lot of sleeping going on in third
shift. Yes,
there
is. Yes, there is. And on the third shift, people stretch out during their breaks and so forth. Yeah. And that's the biggest difference. On day shift, you don't see that. Afternoons, yeah, you might see a little bit of it, but yeah, it's...
Earl Nicholson here on the third shift again. I interrupted Cheryl. You want to go ahead and answer?
No, go ahead.
On the third shift, there was no production on third shift, production run of third shift.
Part of the shift, there should have been production running.
Well, yeah, okay, part of the shift. Okay, yeah. But what primarily were people on third shift doing?
In the trades, their main job was the maintenance end of it, the inspections and so forth. Making sure everything is, you know, that's the only time they got to check it, you know, that and the weekends to do their maintenance. Yeah, they had people that covered the lines, the breakdowns and so forth when the production was running, but after the line goes down, they'd either get something, some type of job that fabricating something or you know, doing the inspections.
Let's take a break. Sam, why did you choose millwright over another trade?
Well, I thought probably that best fit me. I didn't want anything to do with electrical. I probably could have become a pipe fitter, maybe, but I don't know. Millwright does a lot of fabricating and so forth. I kind of like that, so.
What else does a millwright do? What did you do that pertained to production?
Our job for production was to keep the line running. If we had any breakdowns, the conveyor chain breaking, or jobs coming off the line, any really physical work, the millwrights pretty much had a handle on that. Like I always told everybody, they asked me what the millwrights did, and I said anything that the other trades didn't want to do, we kind of did all the crappy stuff, that, you know, the hard work part of it, I'd say. But
so you're a small guy. How tall are you?
I'm about 5'5", if I stand up straight. When I hired in the shop there, I probably weighed 140 pounds. Of course, I've porked out a little bit since then. I'm up probably, 180. But I'm not a very big person.
You said that one of the things Millwright does is they put the jobs back on the line if they come off.
Right.
Why would they come off, and how often did that happen?
It seems like it happens pretty regular. something getting the conveyor bolts or something. Jobs come undog, and if a job comes unlatched from the chain, they will not make a turn. The other job behind it will push into it and push the body truck right off the line. So then it's our job to put it on the best way we know how. We have these big orange sticks that we carry on our trucks called idiot sticks. A lot of times that's what we end up using because you can't get in there to get a fork truck or something, you know, that nature to put it back on the line.
Sam, your uncle, about how big were these idiot sticks?
I'm going to say probably 6-7 feet long. They're probably 4 to 5 inches thick at the biggest part of them.
And how many Millwrights would it take to get a car back on?
As many as we could get. We work in pairs. If we know we have a bad breakdown, we'll call on our buddies to come out from other areas or whatever and give us a hand. So maybe 4 to 6 Millwrights to get cars on the line. Or if we have a pileup, you know, other places and stuff.
Is that a pretty dangerous thing to do?
Yeah, it can be, yes.
Cheryl McQuay, what was the biggest pileup you ever saw?
I have seen several big pileups. Probably the scariest one that I've seen is in our body shipping area. There's a big decline. It's probably, I'm going to say, 25 feet down, a pretty steep decline. And the chain is broken there several times, and probably have 10, 15 cars that pile up there. And the only bad thing with that is you cannot get in there with equipment to right the situation. You have to get the cars out of the way to fix the chain and so forth. And this is pretty much buried in a confined space where you can't get the big equipment in there that you need to do it. So it's all manual labor. You have to hook chains on and secure the jobs so they don't, you know, get away from you and hurt someone or cause more of a pileup.
Do those jobs get damaged and are no longer any good? Or?
Oh yeah. Usually when the cars are piled up like that, they're basically junk. So that's another thing we have to carry, haul them outside, and they go to the scrap metal.
Did you ever see anybody get hurt in one of these pileups?
No, we're pretty much looking out for each other. It's pretty serious business there when you're in a situation like that. So.
What does one of these, I don't know even if you know this, but the car, the carrier, the whole unit, what does that weigh?
I'm guessing probably 3,000 to 4,000 pounds. The body truck itself, I think, is around 2,000 pounds, and then depending on how far the car is assembled, you know, it's maybe another 1,000 pounds or more. The car body itself.
Gary Judy.
So Sam, you never saw any production employees get pinched between those carriers, or anybody get hurt, where you had to respond and release, get them released from it? Or
I can tell you one situation. I saw a production person get injured, not as bad as I thought it would be, but I was on my way up to 3X, and we carry these two-way radios, and the dispatch called and said that we have a production person trapped between two of these body trucks and carriers, and I happened to be almost to that particular location and went up there, and this gentleman was working, he was fitting the trunk lids, and he was working between the two body carriers, and there's a where the two conveyors come together. Well, he didn't pay attention to it, and he become trapped between the two carriers. And I went up there, and I had to. We have a, what we call a blitz buggy that we drive, and it has a torch and welder and so forth. And I went up there and I cut the dog off the conveyor chain to release the tension on the body truck and refreed him. But
so how bad was he hurt? Did he break a leg or?
He was just trapped in there. He had some bruises on his shins and stuff. But I when I first heard the call, these conveyors can cut you right in two. They have no mercy on a human person, and I thought that his probably his legs were crushed, and it wasn't the case. He was just trapped, and he couldn't get out. It just had him, and he was a very lucky man. So that's probably one of the things that I've run across that, you know, where people got hurt.
Earl Nicholson.
I've heard rumors that the chain, that somebody had told me that the chain had 10,000 pounds PSI on it. Is that close? I mean, that's a tremendous amount of energy.
I'm going to say that you could be very well close in that. It does a lot of destructive things, but we have safety measures and that shouldn't let it do some of the stuff that it does. But it's a pretty big chain, and yeah, it takes a lot to break it.
Have you ever seen that chain do anything crazy?
Yes, I have. Yeah, I've seen it jump, jerk around, break. I've pretty much seen it all. It's you go on enough breakdowns, you see a lot of stuff that is crazy.
Okay, now this question is about supervision. You guys are a professional group of guys, you know, but how important is it to have a qualified supervisor?
It's like you said, we supposedly are professionals. I mean, every job's different, but we kind of know what we want to do with certain situations, and having the right supervisor is a big difference. You have some supervisors that don't have a clue, and they want you to get in there, and their main objective is getting the line running, but you know, you have to do it on safe, you know, you don't want to go in there
So when the supervisor, you're on the scene, supervisor, and your maintenance supervisor shows up, do they ask you what the situation is, or do they just go and look for themselves?
They ask you, and they're looking too. A lot of the supervisors, the better supervisors are trades people themselves, so they have some ideas.
So they had a level of trust in their people, that confidence.
Yeah, and they know which people are capable of doing this and which people. It's like I said before, in society, you know, people are better at certain things than they are at other things, and they know the level of ability of people that they got on the job to handle the stuff, you know.
Ever had an instance of having a super an incompetent?
Yes.
Anybody you want to mention by name?
we've had some upper management that had some different ideas about stuff. Leonard Borma, is that name? he had us do some crazy things. He had the line down for like 3.5 hours. And my question was, do we have another part to go in here? And they kind of didn't hear me, didn't want to hear me. He said, let's get this going. And I said, do we have another part to replace this? And they said, let's do it this way, let's do it that way. And he was running the show. He said, I want you to weld this, I want you to do this. And we did it, and it's still, the conveyor would not run. And they ended up sending production home, and then they said, well, let's go up and get this other part, put it in. It only took us 30 minutes to put it in. I mean, It's like one of our supervisors said, yeah, it took you guys 3.5 hours to prove this man wrong. And that was kind of the way this conversation went.
Gary, Judy, so being a millwright, maybe you could tell me if this was true or not. Could they actually speed the chain up? Because we always used to hear on production, and it felt like it a lot of times, that they would speed the chain up and you would be running on the line. Was that actually possible for them to speed that chain up, turn it up from what it was supposed to be to get more jobs out?
That's not a millwright job, but to answer your question, yes, that is possible.
Do you think they did that in the
plant? I'll tell you how it works. There's in the control room, there's a... can't remember the name of it, but what it looks like is the old style, the analog gas pumps, and that's the mechanism that they use. And it's just a matter of turning the to make it run faster, and this is what controls the conveyors. And yes, they can.
You think they actually did that?
Like I say, it's not my job. I don't know. Electricians are capable of doing that. All they had to do is go in there and do it. I know for a fact that one of our conveyors that they used to manipulate, it was a conveyor that at the very end of the line that took them up into 5 second where the marshalling area was there. I know the K conveyor is the name of the conveyor. I know that they used to manipulate that, but they used to speed it up, but the only problem with that, and the only reason we knew it was sped up, was because they speed that up, and then you had to pull the jobs off this conveyor with pullers, and the pullers weren't running fast enough to take away the jobs, so consequently it held the line, so they lost whatever they were trying to gain, and that used to be a little game we played between the first and second shift. First shift would speed it up, second shift to slow it down. Because they would go, hey, we lost 3-4 minutes. And it's because they sped it up. I mean, it don't sound right, but that's the way it worked. It was, you could only get so many cars off the end of that line, and then if it couldn't move them, then it held the line. And when that conveyor stopped, all production stopped. So. But yeah, they could speed it up, if that's the answer you're looking for.
Well, sure, they did it. How much conveyor was in that plant?
I guess it's good enough. Several miles.
Miles?
Miles, yeah. I don't remember. I've seen things on it, but yeah, there's more conveyor than the average person would ever think there's in there. Different styles of conveyor, too.
Earl Nicholson asked you a question earlier about... PSI. What is PSI?
PSI?
Yeah.
Pounds. PSI. Pounds per square inch.
I was unclear of that. Yeah. I didn't know.
I'm trying to think.
Yeah, Earl Nicholson here. I'd like to ask all the fun questions. Everybody else is so serious. What is the most dirtiest? Now, I'm saying this because when you look at all the other skilled trade guys, I mean, they're usually pretty clean, but when you see the millwrights come, you know, sometimes they're just filthy. And I'm just kind of curious, what is the most dirtiest, most nastiest, most unpleasant experience that you've had in the factory?
I would have to say when I worked in paint, primer booths, stuff like that, ovens, I've been in the ovens, it is so dirty, not dirty, but the paint is piled up on, like, on the handrails of the, going up into the ovens, up into the stairways going up there, anything you touch, you got this paint on you, I mean, and it's so sticky that you can walk almost out of your shoes. And if you get in a breakdown in that situation, you've got it all over you. And this stuff will not come off. I mean, you have to scrub it off. That's, you know, grease, yeah, we get that. We get that just, you know, doing anything, but the paint is really nasty. That's got to be the dirtiest job.
Sam, Marilyn Coulter. Question, that was your dirtiest job. Can you tell me about maybe one of the most happiest moments you had in the plant?
My retirement.
Your retirement?
What day? Probably 50 guys show up at my retirement when I retired. Yeah.
So what did they do for your retirement?
Oh, the common thing for our guys is we buy pizzas, DeLuca's pizzas, and you get to invite your family in, and then you really see how many friends you have because there's a ton of people that show up. You know, it's pretty, yeah.
So they had fun. Did they give you any kind of gift, any kind of memorabilia? Did they do
you get a plaque. They have a book that they pass around. All the people that know you sign it. Yeah, it's, makes you feel like that you're... you accomplished something, I guess.
During your time there, were you ever active with your union?
I went over and voted, but as far as going to the meetings, I probably didn't go to as many meetings as I could have, but I've been to meetings before.
Okay. As we come to a close, I want to know, they often called Lansing, Fisher Body, capital of quality. What do you think made our workforce special, made us a cut above the rest, that made us the capital of quality?
I don't know. Our relationship between I think management and the workers, I think is I don't know about the other plants, but I think we have a pretty good working relationship. I mean, obviously, you know, back when I hired in, we used to have a board out front, and we were, like, in the top three. You know, and this plant was one of the plants that still trucked our bodies, and we were still making money even trucking the bodies. So, I don't know. I just got to believe that a lot of people took a lot of pride in what they did. I mean, I don't know. When I hired in, you know, that's what they told you. You know, this place comes first, and that's the way I took it.
Sam, you hired in, 1968, yes?
Yeah.
And you've been retired for how long?
Since June.
Since June. And you live in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So the place that you worked, fed your family off of, you know, built product, and lived in the community... Now you're retired, but the Fisher Body, which changed into Lansing Car Center, now is closed, and it's going to be getting torn down. And it's a part of your community. It's a place where you work. Can you tell us how that makes you feel? What do you think about it?
Well, I'll tell you, the day I retired, of course, production had already ceased here. And the last day I was at work, I knew all this was coming to an end, and I was walking out. I tell you what, you know, it's just a building, but I spent almost 37 years there, and I was walking out, and not a real emotional person, but gosh, that's kind of your life, you know. And I walked out. I thought I did some hard thinking when I was walking out the door, to be honest with you.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you very much. Do you have anything that we didn't ask you that you would want to hear?
No.
Thank you.